said, his tone making clear that he had. Wait, seriously? May reached for the phone.
Don't, he said. It's mine.
He shoved it into his pocket.
It's yours? What we just did is yours?
It's just as much mine as yours, and I was the one having, you know, a climax. And why do you care? You weren't naked or anything.
Francis, I can't believe this. Delete that, now.
Did you say delete? He said, jokingly, but the meaning was clear. We don't delete at the circle.
I have to have a way to see it myself.
Then everyone can see it.
I won't advertise it or anything.
Francis, please.
Come on, May.
You have to understand how much this means to me. I'm not some stud. This is a rare occasion for me to have something like this happen. Can't I keep a memento of the experience?
You can't worry,
Annie said. They were in the great room of the Enlightenment. In a rare occurrence, Stenton was to give the ideas talk, with the promise of a special guest.
But I am worrying, May said.
She'd been unable to concentrate in the week since her encounter with Francis. The video hadn't been viewed by anyone else, but if it was on his phone, it was in the circle cloud and accessible to anyone. More than anything, she was disappointed in herself. She'd let the same man do the same thing to her twice.
Don't ask me again to delete it,
Annie said, waving to a few senior circlers in the crowd, members of the Gang of 40.
Please delete it.
You know I can't. We don't delete here, May. Bailey would freak. He'd weep. It hurts him personally when anyone even considers the deleting of any information. It's like killing babies, he says. You know that.
But this baby's giving a hand job. No one wants that baby. We need to delete that baby.
No one will ever see it. You know that. 99% of the stuff in the cloud is never seen by anyone. If it even gets one view, we can talk again. Okay?
Annie put her hand on May's.
Now watch this. You don't know how rare it is to have Stenton doing the address. This must be big, and it must involve some kind of government thing. That's his niche.
You don't know what he's about to say?
I have some idea, she said.
Stenton took the stage without an introduction. The audience applauded, but in a way that was markedly different from the way they had for Bailey. Bailey was their talented uncle who had saved every one of their lives personally. Stenton was their boss, for whom they had to act professionally and clap professionally. In a flawless black suit, no tie, he walked to the center of the stage, and without introducing himself or saying hello, he began.
As you know, he said, transparency is something we advocate here at the Circle. We look to a guy like Stewart as an inspiration, a man who's willing to open up his life to further our collective knowledge. He's been filming, recording, every moment of his life now for 5 years, and it's been an invaluable asset to the Circle, and soon, I bet, to all of humankind.
Stewart?
Stenton looked out to the audience and found Stewart, the transparent man, standing with what looked like a small telephoto lens around his neck. He was bald, about 60, bending slightly as if from the weight of the device resting on his chest. He got a warm round of applause before sitting down.
Meanwhile, Stenton said, there's another area of public life where we want and expect transparency, and that's democracy. We're lucky to have been born and raised in a democracy, but one that is always undergoing improvements. When I was a kid, to combat backroom political deals, for example, citizens insisted upon sunshine laws. These laws give citizens access to meetings, to transcripts. They could attend public hearings and petition for documents. And yet still, so long after the founding of this democracy, every day our elected leaders still find themselves embroiled in some scandal or another, usually involving them doing something they shouldn't be doing. Something secretive, illegal, against the will and best interests of the Republic. No wonder public trust for Congress is at 11%.
There was a wave of murmuring from the audience. Stenton fed off it.
Congressional approval is actually at 11%, and as you know, a certain senator was just revealed to be involved in some very unsavory business.
The crowd laughed, cheered, tittered. May leaned to Annie.
Wait, what senator? Williamson, you didn't hear? She got busted for all kinds of weird stuff. She's under investigation for a half dozen things, all kinds of ethical violations. They found everything on her computer, 100 weird searches, downloads, some very creepy stuff.
May thought, unwillingly, of Francis. She turned her attention back to Stenton.
Your occupation could be dropping human feces on the heads of senior citizens, he said. And your job approval would be higher than 11%. So what can be done? What can be done to restore the people's trust in their elected leaders? I am happy to say that there's a woman who is taking all this very seriously, and she's doing something to address the issue. Let me introduce Olivia Santos, representative from District 14.
A stout woman of about 50, wearing a red suit and a yellow floral scarf, strode from the wings, both arms waving high over her head. From the scattered and polite applause, it was clear that few in the great hall knew who she was. Stenton gave her a stiff hug, and as she stood beside him, her hands clasped in front of her, he continued.
For those who need a civics refresher, Congresswoman Santos represents this very district. It's okay if you didn't know her. Now you do.
He turned to her.
How are you today, Congresswoman?
I'm fine, Tom, very fine. Very happy to be here.
Stenton offered his version of a warm smile to her, and then turned back to the audience.
Congresswoman Santos is here to announce what I must say is a very important development in the history of government, and that is a move toward the ultimate transparency that we've all sought from our elected leaders since the birth of representative democracy. Congresswoman?
Stenton stepped back and sat behind her on a high stool. Representative Santos moved to the front of the stage, hands now entwined behind her, and swept her eyes over the room.
That's right, Tom. I'm as concerned as you are about the need for citizens to know what their elected leaders are doing. I mean, it is your right, is it not? It's your right to know how they spend their days, who they're meeting with, who they're talking to, what they're doing on the taxpayer's dime. Until now, it's been an ad hoc system of accountability. Senators and representatives, mayors and councilpersons have occasionally released their schedules and have allowed citizens varying degrees of access. But still we wonder, why are they meeting with that former senator-turned-lobbyist, and how did that congressman get that $150,000 the FBI found hidden in his fridge? How did that other senator arrange and carry out trysts with a series of women while his wife was undergoing cancer treatment? I mean, the array of misdeeds carried out while these officials were being paid by you, the citizenry, is not only deplorable, not only unacceptable, but also unnecessary.
There was a smattering of applause. Santos smiled, nodded, and continued.
We've all wanted and expected transparency from our elected leaders, but the technology wasn't there to make it fully possible. But now it is. As Stewart has demonstrated, it's very easy to provide the world at large full access to your day, to see what you see, hear what you hear, and what you say. Thank you for your courage, Stewart.
The audience applauded again for Stewart with new vigor, some of them guessing what Santos was about to announce.
So I intend to follow Stewart on his path of illumination, and along the way, I intend to show how democracy can and should be. Entirely open, entirely transparent. Starting today, I will be wearing the same device that Stewart wears. My every meeting, movement, my every word will be available to all my constituents and to the world.
Stenton got off his stool and made his way to Santos. He looked out to the assembled circlers.
Can we give Congresswoman Santos a round of applause?
But the audience was already clapping. There were whoops and whistles, and Santos beamed. While they roared, a technician emerged from the wings and hung a necklace around Santos's head, a smaller version of the camera Stewart had been wearing. Santos held the lens to her lips and kissed it. The audience cheered. After a minute, Stenton raised his hands, and the crowd quieted. He turned to Santos.
So you're saying that every conversation, every meeting, every part of your day will be broadcast?
Yes, it will all be available on my circle page, every moment till I sleep.
The audience applauded again, and Stenton indulged them, then again asked for quiet.
And what if those who want to meet with you don't want a given meeting to be broadcast?
Well, then, they will not meet with me, she said. You're either transparent or you're not. You're either accountable or you're not. What would anyone have to say to me that couldn't be said in public? What part of representing the people should not be known by the very people I'm representing?
The applause was drowning her out.
Indeed, Stenton said.
Thank you, thank you,
Santos said, bowing, putting her palms together in a posture of prayer. The applause continued for minutes. Finally, Stenton gestured for calm once more.
So, when are you starting this new program?
He asked.
No time like the present, she said.
She pushed a button on the device around her neck, and there it was, the view from her camera projected on the giant screen behind her. The audience saw itself with great clarity and roared with approval.
It begins now for me, Tom, she said. And I hope it begins soon for the rest of the elected leaders in this country and for those in every one of the world's democracies.
She bowed. She put her hands together again and then began to walk off the stage. As she was nearing the curtains at stage left, she stopped.
There's no reason for me to go that way. Too dark. I'm going this way, she said,
and the lights in the auditorium came on as she stepped down to the floor into the bright light, the room's thousand faces suddenly visible and cheering. She walked straight up the aisle, all the hands reaching to her, grinning faces telling her, thank you, go forth and make us proud. That night in the colony, there was a reception for Congresswoman Santos, and she continued to be swarmed with new admirers. May briefly entertained the notion of trying to get close enough to shake her hand, but the crowd around her was five deep all night, so instead May ate from the buffet, some kind of shredded pork that had been made on campus, and waited for Annie. She'd said she would try to make it down, but was on a deadline, preparing something for a hearing at the EU. They're whining about taxes again, she said. May wandered the room, which had been decorated in a vaguely desert theme, with smatterings of cacti and sandstone in front of walls of digital sunsets. She saw and said hello to Dan and Jared and a few of the newbies she'd been training. She looked for Francis, hoping he wouldn't be there, but then remembered with great relief that he was at a conference in Las Vegas, a gathering of law enforcement agencies he was introducing to Child Track. As she wandered, a wall-screen sunset faded to make way for the face of Ty. His face was unshaven, and there were bags under his eyes, and though he was clearly and thoroughly tired, he was smiling broadly. He was wearing his customary oversized black hoodie and took a moment to clean his glasses on his sleeve before looking out at the room, left and right, as if he could see them all from wherever he was. Maybe he could. The room quickly hushed.
Hey, everyone. Sorry I can't be there with you all. I've been working on some very interesting new projects that are keeping me away from incredible social activities like the one you're enjoying, but I did want to congratulate you all on this phenomenal new development. I think it's a crucial new step for the Circle and will mean a great deal to our overall awesomeness.
For a second, he seemed to be looking at whoever was operating the camera, as if confirming he'd said enough. Then his eyes returned to look into the room.
Thank you all for your hard work on it, and let the party truly begin.
His face disappeared, and the wall screen again displayed the digital sunset. May chatted with some of the newbies in her pod, some of whom hadn't seen any live addresses from Ty before and were close to euphoric. May took a picture, zinged it, and added a few words.
Exciting stuff.
May picked up her second glass of wine, deciding how she could do so without taking the napkin under it, which would serve no purpose and end up in her pocket. When she saw Calden, he was in a shadowy stairwell, sitting on the steps. She meandered her way over to him, and when he saw her, his face brightened.
Oh, hi, he said.
Oh, hi? Sorry, he said, and leaned into her, intending a hug. She recoiled.
Where have you been?
Ben?
You disappeared for 2 weeks,
May said.
It hasn't been that long, has it?
And I've been around. I looked for you one day, but you looked busy.
You came to see E?
I did, but I didn't want to bother you.
And you couldn't leave a message somehow?
I didn't know your last name, he said, smiling as if he knew far more than he was letting on.
Why didn't you contact me?
I didn't know your last name either, and there's no Cowden listed anywhere.
Really? How are you spelling it?
May began to enumerate the permutations she'd tried when he interrupted. Listen, it doesn't matter. We both screwed up, and now we're here.
May stepped back to take him in, thinking maybe somewhere on him she would find some clue as to whether or not he was real, a real circler, a real person. Again, he was wearing a snug long-sleeved shirt, this one with narrow horizontal stripes in greens and reds and browns, and again he had maneuvered his way into very narrow black pants that gave his legs the look of an inverted V.
You do work here, right? She asked.
Of course. How else could I get in? Security is pretty good here. Especially on a day like today, with our luminous guest. He nodded to the congresswoman, who was signing her name on someone's tablet.
You look like you're ready to leave, May said.
Do I? Cowden said.
No, I'm just comfortable back here. I like to sit during these things, and I guess I like to have the option of fleeing.
He threw his thumb over his shoulder, indicating the stairs behind him.
I'm just glad my supervisors saw me here, May said. That was my first priority. Do you have to be seen here by a supervisor or anything?
Supervisor?
For a moment, Cowden looked at her as if she'd just said something in a familiar and yet incomprehensible language.
Oh, yeah, he said, nodding. They saw me here. I took care of that.
Have you told me what you do here yet?
I don't know. Have I?
Look at that guy.
What guy?
Oh, never mind, Cowden said, seeming to have already forgotten whom he was looking at.
So you're in PR?
No, customer experience.
Cowden tilted his head.
Oh, I knew that, he said, unconvincingly.
You've been there a while?
May had to laugh. The man was not all there. His mind seemed barely tethered to his body, much less the earth.
I'm sorry, he said, his face turning to her, now looking impossibly sincere and clear-eyed.
But I want to remember these things about you. I was actually hoping I'd see you here.
How long have you worked here again? She asked.
Me?
He scratched the back of his head.
Wow, I don't know, while now.
1 month? A year? 6 years? She asked, thinking he really was some kind of savant.
6? He said. That would be the beginning. You think I look old enough to have been here 6 years? I don't want to look that old. Is it the gray hair?
May had no idea what to say. Of course it was the gray hair.
Should we get a refreshment? She asked.
No, you go ahead, he said.
Afraid to leave your hideout?
No, just feeling less social.
She made her way to a table where a few hundred glasses of wine had been poured and were waiting.
May, right?
She turned to find the two women, Dana and Hillary, who were building a submersible for Stanton. May remembered meeting them on her first day, and since then she had been getting their updates on her second screen at least 3 a day. They were weeks away from finishing the craft. Stanton planned to take it to the Marianas Trench.
I've been following your progress, May said.
Incredible. You're building it here?
May glanced over her shoulder to make sure Cowden hadn't made a quick exit.
With the Project 9 guys, yeah,
Hillary said, waving a hand at some other unknown part of the campus.
Safer to build it here, to keep the patented stuff secure. This is the first vessel big enough to really bring back full-sized animal life, Dana said.
And you guys get to go?
Dana and Hillary laughed.
No,
Hillary said.
This thing's built for one man and one man only, Tom Stanton.
Dana looked askance at Hillary, then back to May.
The costs of making it big enough for more people are pretty much prohibitive.
Right,
Hillary said.
That's what I meant.
When May returned to Cowden's stairwell, holding 2 glasses of wine, he was in the same place, but he had somehow gotten himself 2 glasses of his own.
Someone came by with a tray, he said, standing up.
They stood briefly, each two-fisted, and May could think of nothing but clinking all four glasses together, which they did.
I ran into the team building the submersible, May said. You know them?
Cowden rolled his eyes. It was startling. May hadn't seen anyone else do that at the circle.
What?
May said.
Nothing,
he said.
Did you like the speech?
He asked.
The whole Santos thing? I did. Very exciting.
She was careful with her words.
I think this will be a momentous, moment in the history of demo-
She paused, seeing him smile.
What?
She said.
Nothing, he said.
You don't have to give me a speech. I heard what Stenton said. You really think this is a good idea?
You don't?
He shrugged and drained half his glass. That guy just concerns me sometimes. Then knowing he shouldn't have said that about one of the wise men, he changed tacks. He's just so smart, it's intimidating.
You really think I look old?
What would you say? 30?
You don't look that old,
May said.
I don't believe you. I know I do.
May drank from one of her glasses. They looked around, watching the feed from Santos's camera. It was being projected onto the far wall, and a group of circlers stood, watching, while Santos mingled a few feet away. One circler found his own image caught on the congresswoman's camera and positioned his hand to cover his second, projected face. Cowden watched closely, his brow furrowed.
Hmm,
he said. He tilted his head, like a traveler puzzling out some odd local customs. Then he turned to May and looked at her two glasses and at his own, as if just now realizing the humor in both of them standing two-fisted in a doorway.
I'm going to get rid of this one,
he said, and down the glass in his left hand. May followed suit.
Sorry,
she said, for no reason. She knew she would soon be tipsy, probably too tipsy to hide it. Bad decisions would ensue. She tried to think of something intelligent to say while she could.
So where does all that go?
She asked.
The stuff from the camera?
Yeah, is it stored somewhere here? The cloud?
Well, it's in the cloud, sure, but it has to be stored in a physical place, too. The stuff from Stewart's camera...
Wait, you want to see something? He was already halfway down the stairwell, his limbs nimble and spidery.
I don't know,
May said. Cowden looked up, as if he'd had his feelings hurt.
I can show you where Stewart is stored. You want to?
I'm not taking you to some dungeon. May looked around the room, scanning for Dan and Jared, but couldn't find them. She'd stayed an hour, and they'd seen her, so she assumed she could leave. She took a few pictures, posted them, and sent a series of zings detailing and commenting on the proceedings. Then she followed Cowden down the stairs, three flights, to what she assumed was the basement.
I'm really trusting you,
she said.
You should,
Cowden said, approaching a large blue door. He passed his fingers over a wall-mounted pad, and it opened.
Come.
She followed him down a long hallway, and she had the feeling she was passing from one building to another through some tunnel far underground. Soon another door appeared, and again Cowden released the lock with his fingerprints. May followed, almost giddy, intrigued by his extraordinary access, too tipsy to measure the wisdom of following this calligraphic man through this labyrinth. They rode down what May guessed was four floors, exited into another long corridor, and then entered another stairwell, where they again went down. May soon found her second glass of wine cumbersome, so she finished it.
"Anywhere I can put this?"
she asked. Without a word, Cowden took the glass and left it on the lowest step of the stairway they'd just finished. Who was this person? He had access to every door he encountered, but he also had an anarchic streak. No one else at the circle would abandon a glass like that, which amounted to some grand act of pollution, and no one else would take such a journey in the middle of a company party. There was a muffled part of May that knew Cowden was likely a troublemaker here, and that what they were doing was probably against some or all rules and regulations.
I still don't know what you do here, she said.
They were walking through a dimly lit corridor that sloped gently downward and with no apparent end. He turned.
Not much. I go to meetings, I listen, I provide feedback. It's not very important, he said, walking briskly ahead of her.
Do you know Annie Allerton?
Of course, I love Annie.
Now he turned back to her.
Hey, you still have that lemon I gave you?
No, it never turned yellow.
Huh?
He said, and his eyes briefly left their focus on her, as if they were needed somewhere else, somewhere deep in his mind, for a brief but crucial calculation.
Where are we? May asked. I feel like we're 1,000 feet underground.
Not quite, he said, his eyes returning. But close. Have you heard of Project Nine?
Project Nine, as far as May knew, was the all-encompassing name for the secret research being done at the Circle. Anything from space technology, Stanton thought the Circle could design and build a far better reusable spacecraft, to what was rumored to be a plan to embed and make accessible massive amounts of data in human DNA.
Is that where we're going? May asked.
No, he said, and opened another door. They entered a large room about the size of a basketball court, dimly lit before 12 spotlights trained on an enormous red metallic box the size of a bus. Each side was smooth, polished, the whole thing surrounded by a network of gleaming silver pipes forming an elaborate grid around it.
It looks like some kind of Donald Judd sculpture, May said.
Calden turned to her, his face alight.
I'm so glad you said that. He was a big inspiration to me. I love that thing he once said. Things that exist, exist, and everything is on their side. You ever see his stuff in person?
May was only passingly familiar with the work of Donald Judd. They'd done a few days on him in one of her art history classes, but didn't want to disappoint Calden.
No, but I love him, she said. I love his heft.
And with that, something new appeared on Calden's face, some new respect for or interest in May, as if at that moment she'd become three-dimensional and permanent.
Then May ruined it.
He did this for the company? She said, nodding at the massive red box. Calden laughed, then looked at her, his interest in her not gone, but certainly in retreat.
No, he's been dead for decades. This was just inspired by his aesthetic. This is actually a machine, or inside it is. It's a storage unit.
He looked at May, expecting her to complete the thought. She couldn't.
This is Stuart, he finally said.
May knew nothing about data storage, but had been under the general idea that storing such information could be done in a far smaller space.
All this for one person? She asked.
Well, it's the storage of the raw data and then the capacity to run all kinds of scenarios through it. Every bit of video is being mapped 100 different ways. Everything Stuart sees is correlated with the rest of the video we have, and it helps map the world and everything in it. And of course, what you get through Stuart's cameras is exponentially more detailed and layered than any consumer device.
And why have it here, as opposed to store it in the cloud or in the desert somewhere?
Well, some people like to scatter their ashes, and some like to have a plot close to home, right? May wasn't precisely sure what that meant, but she didn't feel she could admit that.
And the pipes are for electricity? She asked.
Calden opened his mouth, paused, then smiled.
No, that's water. A ton of water is needed to keep the processors cool, so the water runs through the system, cooling the overall apparatus, millions of gallons every month. You want to see Santos's room?
He led her through a door to another identical room, with another great red box dominating the space.
This was supposed to be for someone else, but when Santos stepped up, it was assigned to her.
May had already said too many silly things that night and was feeling lightheaded, so she didn't ask the questions she wanted to ask, such as, how could these things take up so much space and use so much water? And if even 100 more people wanted to store there every minute, and surely millions would opt to go transparent, would beg to, how could we do this when each life took up so much space? Where would all these great red boxes go?
Oh, wait. Something's about to happen, Calden said, and he took her hand, and he led her back into Stuart's room, where the two of them stood,
listening to the hum of the machines.
"Has it happened?"
May asked, thrilling at the feel of his hand, his palm soft and his fingers warm and long. Cowden raised his eyebrows, telling her to wait. A loud rush came from overhead, the unmistakable movement of water. May looked up, briefly thinking they would be drenched, but realized it was only the water coming through the pipes, heading for Stuart, cooling all he'd done and seen.
"Such a pretty sound, don't you think?"
Cowden said, looking to her, his eyes seeming to want to get back to the place where May was something more than ephemeral.
"Beautiful,"
she said. And then, because the wine had her teetering, and because he'd just held her hand, and because something about the rush of water set her free, she took Cowden's face in her hands and kissed his lips. His hands rose from his sides and held her, tentatively, around the waist, just his fingertips, as if she were a balloon he didn't want to pop. But for a terrible moment, his mouth was inanimate, stunned. May thought she'd made a mistake. Then, as if a bundle of signals and directives had finally reached his cerebral cortex, his lips awakened and returned the force of her kiss.
"Hold on,"
he said after a moment, and pulled away. He nodded toward the red box containing Stuart and led her by the hand out of the room and into a narrow corridor she hadn't seen before. It was unlit, and as they stepped further, the light from Stuart no longer penetrated.
"Now I'm scared,"
May said.
"Almost there,"
he said. And then there was the creaking of a steel door. It opened and revealed an enormous chamber illuminated by weak blue light. Cowden led her through the doorway and into what seemed to be a great cave, 30 feet high, with a barrel-vaulted ceiling.
"What is this?"
she asked.
"It was supposed to be part of the subway," he said, "but they abandoned it. Now it's just empty, a strange combination of man-made tunnel and actual cave. See the stalactites?"
He pointed down the great tunnel, where stalagmites and stalactites gave the tunnel the look of a mouth full of uneven teeth.
"Where does it go?"
she asked.
"It connects to the one under the bay,"
he said.
"I've gone about a half mile into it, but then it gets too wet."
Where they stood, they could see black water, a shallow lake on the tunnel floor.
"My guess is that this is where the future Stuarts will go," he said. "Thousands of them, probably smaller. I'm sure they'll get the containers down to people size soon enough."
They looked into the tunnel together, and May pictured it, an endless grid of red steel boxes stretching into the darkness. He looked back to her.
"You can't tell anyone I took you here."
"I won't," May said, then knew that, to keep this promise, she would have to lie to Annie. In the moment, it seemed a small price to pay. She wanted to kiss Cowden again, and she took his face again, down to hers, and opened her mouth to his. She closed her eyes and pictured the long cave, the blue light above, the dark water below. And then, in the shadows, away from Stuart, something in Cowden changed, and his hands became more sure of themselves. He held her closer, his hands gaining strength. His mouth moved from hers across her cheek and onto her neck, pausing there, and climbing to her ear, his breath hot. She tried to keep up, holding his head in her hands, exploring his neck, his back, but he was leading. He had plans. His right hand was on the small of her back, bringing her into him, where she felt him hard and pressing against her stomach. And then she was lifted, she was in the air, and he was carrying her, and she wrapped her legs around him as he strode purposefully to some point behind her. She opened her eyes briefly, then closed them, not wanting to know where he was taking her, trusting him, though knowing how wrong this was, trusting him so far underground, a man she couldn't find, whose full name she didn't know. Then he was lowering her, and she braced herself to feel the stone of the cave floor, but instead she felt the soft landing of some kind of mattress. Now she opened her eyes. They were in an alcove, a cave within the cave, a few feet off the ground and carved into the wall. It was filled with blankets and pillows, and he eased her down upon them.
"This is where you sleep?"
she asked, in her fevered state, thinking it almost logical.
"Sometimes,"
he said, and breathed fire into her ear. She remembered the condoms she'd been given at Dr. Villalobos's office.
I have something, she said.
Good, he said, and he took one from her, tearing the wrapper as she pushed his pants down his hips. In two quick motions, he pulled her pants and panties down and tossed them aside. He buried his face in her stomach, his hands holding the back of her thighs, his fingers crawling upward, inward.
Come back up here, she said.
He did, and he hissed into her ear.
May.
She couldn't form words.
May,
he said again, as she fell apart all over him. She woke up in the dorms and first imagined she'd dreamt it every moment. The underground chambers, the water, the red boxes, that hand on the small of her back, and then the bed, the pillows in the cave within the cave. None of it seemed plausible. It was a kind of random assemblage of details that dreams fumbled with, none of it possible in this world. But as she rose and showered and dressed, she realized that everything had happened the way she remembered. She had kissed this person, Calden, who she knew very little about, and he had led her not only through a series of high-security chambers, but into some dark anteroom where they'd lost themselves for hours and passed out. She called Annie.
We consummated.
Who did? You and the old man?
He's not old.
He didn't have a musty smell? Did he mention his pacemaker or diapers? Don't tell me he died on you.
He's not even 30.
Did you get his last name this time?
No, but he gave me a number where I can call him.
Oh, that's classy. And have you tried it?
Not yet.
Not yet? May's stomach tightened. Annie exhaled loudly. You know I'm worried about him being some kind of spy or stalker. Did you confirm that he's legit?
I did. He works at the Circle. He said he knew you, and he had access to lots of places. He's normal. Maybe a little eccentric.
Access to places? What do you mean?
Annie's tone took on a new edge. At that moment, May knew she would begin lying to Annie. May wanted to be with Calden again, wanted to throw herself around him at that moment, and she didn't want Annie to do anything to jeopardize her access to him and his broad shoulders, his elegant silhouette.
I just mean he knew his way around, May said. There was a part of her that thought he might indeed be there illegally, that he was some interloper, and, in a sudden revelation, she realized he might be living in that strange underground lair. He might represent some force opposed to the Circle. Maybe he worked for Senator Williamson in some capacity, or some would-be competitor to the Circle. Maybe he was a simple nobody blogger stalker who wanted to get closer to the machine at the center of the world.
So you consummated where? In your dorm?
Yup, May said. It was not so difficult to lie this way.
And he slept over?
No, he had to get home. And realizing that the longer she spent talking to Annie, the more lies she would tell, May concocted a reason to hang up.
I'm supposed to get hooked up for the Circle survey today, she said,
which was more or less true.
Call me later, and you have to get his name.
Okay.
May, I'm not your boss. I don't want to be your supervisor or anything, but the company needs to know who this guy is. Company security is something we have to take seriously. Let's get him nailed down today, okay?
Annie's voice had changed. She sounded like a displeased superior. May held her anger and hung up. May called the number Calden had given her, but when she did, the phone rang without end. There was no voicemail, and again May realized she had no way to get in touch with him. Intermittently, throughout the night, she thought to ask him his last name for any other kind of information, but the time was never right, and he hadn't asked for hers, and she assumed that when they left each other, they would exchange information. But then they'd forgotten. She, at least, had forgotten. How had they parted, after all? He walked her to the dorms and kissed her again, there, under the doorway. Or maybe not. May thought again and remembered he'd done what he did before. He'd pulled her aside, out of the light of the doorway, and he'd kissed her four times, on her forehead, her chin, each cheek, the stations of the cross. Then he spun away from her, disappearing into the shadows near the waterfall, the one where,
Francis found the wine.
During lunch, May made her way to the Cultural Revolution, where, at the behest of Jared and Josiah and Denise, she would be outfitted to answer circle surveys. She had been assured this was a reward, an honor, and an enjoyable one, to be one of the circlers asked about her tastes, her preferences, her buying habits and plans, for use by the circle's clients.
"This is really the right next step for you,"
Josiah had said. Denise had nodded.
"I think you'll love it."
Pete Ramirez was a blandly handsome man a few years older than May, whose office seemed to have no desk, no chairs, no right angles. It was round. And when May entered, he was standing, talking on a headset, swinging a baseball bat and looking out the window. He waved her in and finished his call. He was still holding the bat with his left hand when he shook her hand with his right.
"May Holland, so good to have you. I know you're on lunch, so we'll be quick. You'll be out in 7 minutes if you forgive my brusqueness, okay?"
"Okay."
"Great. Do you know why you're here?"
"I think so."
"You're here because your opinions are valued. They're so valued that the world needs to know them. Your opinions on just about everything. Isn't that flattering?"
May smiled. "It is."
"Okay, you see this headset I have on?"
He pointed to the assembly on his head, a hair-thin arm, a microphone at its end, followed his cheekbone.
"I'm going to hook you up with the same sweet setup. Sound good?"
May smiled, but Pete wasn't waiting for answers. He arranged an identical headset over her hair and adjusted the microphone.
"Can you say something so I can check the levels?"
He had no tablet or screen visible, so May assumed he was fully retinal, the first one she'd met.
"Just tell me what you ate for breakfast."
"A banana, granola," she said.
"Great. Let's decide first on a sound. Do you have a preferred one for your notices? Like a chirp or a tritone or something?"
"Maybe a standard chirp?"
"This is a chirp," he said, and she heard it through her headphones.
"That's fine."
"It should be better than fine. You'll be hearing it a lot. You want to be sure. Try a few more."
They ran through a dozen more options, finally settling on the sound of a tiny bell, distant and with an intriguing reverb, as if it had been rung in some faraway church.
"Great," Pete said. "Now let me explain how it works. The idea is to take the pulse of a chosen sampling of circle members. This job is important. You've been chosen because your opinions are crucial to us and to our clients. The answers you provide will help us in tailoring our services to their needs. Okay?"
May began to respond, but he was already talking again.
"So every time you hear the bell, you'll nod, and the headset will register your nod, and the question will be heard through your headphone. You'll answer the question in standard English. In many cases, you'll be asked a question that's structured to receive one of the standard two answers, smile and frown. The voice rack is exquisitely attuned to these two answers, so you don't have to worry about mumbling or anything. And of course, you shouldn't have trouble with any answer if you enunciate. You want to try one?"
May nodded, and at the sound of the bell, she nodded, and a question arrived through the earpiece.
"How do you feel about shoes?"
May smiled, then said,
"Smile."
Pete winked at her.
"Easy one."
The voice asked, "How do you feel about dressy shoes?" May said, "Smile." Pete raised his hand in pause.
"Now, of course, the majority of the questions won't be subject to one of the three standard answers, smile, frown, or meh. You can answer any question with more detail. The next one will require more. Here goes."
"How often do you buy new shoes?"
May answered,
"Once every 2 months."
And there was the sound of a tiny bell.
"I heard a bell. Is that good?"
"Yeah, sorry," he said. "I just activated the bell, which will mean your answer was heard and recorded, and that the next question is ready. Then you can nod again, which will bring on your next question, or you can wait for the prompt."
"What's the difference again?"
"Well, you have a certain, well, I don't want to say quota, but there's a number of questions that would be ideal and expected for you to answer in a given workday. Let's call it 500, but it might be more, might be less. You can either get through them on your own pace by powering through or spreading them throughout the workday. Most people can do 500 in an hour, so it's not too stressful. Or you can wait for the prompts, which will occur if the program thinks you should pick up the pace. Have you ever done one of those online traffic court programs?"
May had. There had been 200 questions, and it was estimated that it should take 2 hours to complete. She'd done it in 25 minutes.
"Yes," she said. "This is just like that. I'm sure you can get through the day's questions in no time. Of course, we can increase the pace if you really get going.
Good?"
"Great," she said.
"And then, so if you happen to get busy, after a while there'll be a second signal that reminds you to get back to the questions. This signal should be different. You want to choose a second?" And so they ran through the signals again, and she chose a distant foghorn. Or, he said, there's a random one that some people choose. Listen to this. Actually, hold on a second. He lost his focus on May and talked into his headset. Demo May voice M-A-E. Now he turned to May again. Okay, here it goes. May heard her own voice say her name in something just above a whisper. It was very intimate and sent a strange swirling wind through her. That's your own voice, right? May was flushed, bewildered. It didn't sound like her at all. But she managed to nod. The program does a voice capture from your phone, and then we can form any words, even your own name. So, that should be your second signal? Yes, May said. She wasn't sure she wanted to hear her own voice saying her own name repeatedly, but she knew, too, that she wanted to hear it again as soon as possible. It was so odd, just a few inches from normal. Good, Pete said. So we're done. You get back to your desk, and the first bell will come on. Then you run through as many as you can this afternoon, certainly the first 500. Good?
Good.
Oh, when you get back to your desk, you'll see a new screen. Every so often, one of the questions will be accompanied by an image if it's necessary. We keep these to a minimum, though, because we know you need to concentrate. When May got back to her desk, a new screen, her fifth, had been set up just to the right of her newbie question screen. She had a few minutes before 1 o'clock, so she tested the system. The first bell rang, and she nodded. A woman's voice, sounding like a newscaster's, asked her,
For vacations, are you inclined toward one of relaxation, like a beach or luxury hotel, or are you inclined toward adventure, like a whitewater rafting trip?
May answered, Adventure. A tiny bell rang, faint and pleasant.
Thank you. What sort of adventure? The voice asked.
Whitewater rafting, May answered. Another tiny bell. May nodded.
Thank you. For whitewater rafting, do you prefer a multi-day trip with overnight camping or a day trip?
May looked up to find the room filling with the rest of the pod, returning from work. It was 12:58.
Multi-day,
she said. Another bell. May nodded.
Thank you. How does a trip down the Grand Canyon sound?
Smile. The bell sang faintly. May nodded.
Thank you. Would you be willing to pay $1,200 for a week-long trip down the Grand Canyon?
The voice asked.
Meh,
May said, and looked up to see Jared standing on his chair.
The chute is open!
He yelled. Almost immediately, 12 customer queries appeared. May answered the first, got a 92, followed up, and it rose to 97. She answered the next two for an average of 96.
May?
It was a woman's voice. She looked around, thinking it might be Renata, but there was no one near her.
May?
Now she realized it was her own voice, the prompt she'd agreed to. It was louder than she'd expected, louder than the questions or the bell, and yet it was seductive, thrilling. She turned the volume down on the headset, and again the voice came.
May?
Now, with it turned down, it wasn't nearly as intriguing, so she returned the volume to the previous level.
May?
It was her voice, she knew, but then somehow it sounded less like her and more like some older, wiser version of herself. May had the thought that if she had an older sister who had seen more than she had, that sister's voice would sound like this.
May?
The voice said again. The voice seemed to lift May off her seat and spin her around. Every time she heard it, her heart sped up.
May?
Yes? She said finally. But nothing happened. It was not programmed to answer questions. She hadn't been told how to respond. She tried nodding.
Thank you, May,
her voice said, and the bell rang.
Would you be willing to pay $1,200 for a week-long trip down the Grand Canyon?
The first voice asked again.
Yes.
The bell rang. It was all easy enough to assimilate. The first day, she'd gotten through 652 of the survey questions, and congratulatory messages came from Pete Ramirez, Dan, and Jared. Feeling strong and wanting to impress them even more, she answered 820 the next day and 991 the day after that. It was not difficult, and the validation felt good.
Pete told her how much the clients were appreciating her input, her candor, and her insights. Her aptitude for the program was making it easier to expand it to others in her pod, and by the end of the second week, a dozen others in the room were answering survey questions, too. It took a day or so to get used to, seeing so many people nodding so frequently, and with varying styles, some with sudden bird-like jerks, others more fluidly. But soon it was as normal as the rest of their routines, involving typing and sitting and seeing their work appear on an array of screens. At certain moments, there was the happy visual of a herd of heads nodding in what appeared to be unison, as if there were some common music playing in all of their minds. The extra layer of the circle surveys helped distract May from thinking about Calden, who had yet to contact her and who had not once answered his phone. She'd stopped calling after 2 days and had chosen not to mention him at all to Annie or anyone else. Her thoughts about him followed a similar path as they had after their first encounter at the circus. First, she found his unavailability intriguing, even novel. But after 3 days, it seemed willful and adolescent. By the fourth day, she was tired of the game. Anyone who disappeared like that was not a serious person. He wasn't serious about her or how she felt. He had seemed supremely sensitive each time they'd met, but then, when apart, his absence, because it was total, and because total non-communication in a place like the Circle was so difficult, it felt like violence. Even though Calden was the only man for whom she'd ever had real lust, she was finished. She would rather have someone lesser if that person were available, familiar, locatable. In the meantime, May was improving her circle survey performance. Because their peers' survey numbers were made available, competition was healthy and kept them all on their toes. May's average was 1,345 questions each day, second highest only to a newbie named Sebastian, who sat in the corner and never left his desk for lunch. Given she was still getting the newbie's question overrun on her fourth screen, May felt fine about being second in this one category, especially given her party rank had been in the 1900s all month, and Sebastian had yet to crack 4,000. She was trying to push into the 1800s one Tuesday afternoon, commenting on hundreds of inner circle photos and posts, when she saw a figure in the distance, resting against the door jamb at the far end of the room. It was a man, and he was wearing the same striped shirt Calden was wearing when she'd last seen him. His arms were crossed, his head tilted, as if he was seeing something he couldn't quite understand or believe. May was sure it was Calden, and forgot to breathe. Before she could conceive of a less eager reaction, she waved, and he waved back, raising his hand just above his waist. "May?" the voice said through her headset. And at that moment, the figure in the doorway spun away and was gone. "May?" the voice said again. She took off the headphones and jogged to the door where she'd seen him, but he was gone. She instinctively went to the bathroom where she'd first met him, but he wasn't there either. When she got back to her desk, there was someone in her chair. It was Francis.
"I'm still sorry," he said.
She looked at him, his heavy eyebrows, his boat-keel nose, his tentative smile. May sighed and took him in. That smile, she realized, was the smile of someone who was never sure he'd gotten the joke. Still, May had, in recent days, thought of Francis, the profound contrast he offered to Calden. Calden was a ghost, wanting May to chase him, and Francis was so available, so utterly without mystery. In a weak moment or two, May had wondered what she might do the next time she saw him. Would she succumb to Francis's ready presence, to the simple fact that he wanted to be near her? The question had been in her head for days, but only now did she know the answer. No. He still disgusted her. His meekness, his neediness, his pleading voice, his thievery.
"Have you deleted the video?" she asked.
"No,"
he said. "You know I can't."
Then he smiled, swiveling in her chair. He thought they were being friendly.
"You had an inner circle survey question, and I answered it. I assume you approve of the circle sending aid to Yemen?"
She pictured, briefly, burying her fist in his face.
"Please leave," she said.
"May, no one's watched the video. It's just part of the archive. It's one of 10,000 clips that go up every day here at the Circle alone. One of a billion worldwide, every day."
"Well, I don't want it to be one of the billion."
"May, you know technically neither one of us owns that video anymore. I couldn't delete it if I tried. It's like news.
You don't own the news, even if it happens to you. You don't own history. It's part of the collective record now.
May's head was about to explode. I have to work, she said, managing not to slap him.
Can you leave?
Now he seemed, for the first time, to grasp that she really loathed him and did not want him near. His face twisted into something like a pout. He looked at his shoes.
You know they approved child track in Vegas.
And she felt for him, even if briefly. Francis was a desperate man who'd never had a childhood, had no doubt tried all his life to please those around him, the succession of foster parents who had no intention of keeping him. That's great, Francis, she said. The beginnings of a smile lifted his face. Hoping it might pacify him and allow her to get back to work, she went further. You're saving a lot of lives. Now he beamed.
You know, in 6 months it could be all over. It could be everywhere. Full saturation. Every child trackable. Every child safe forever. Stenton told me this himself. Did you know he visited my lab? He's taken a personal interest, and apparently they might change the name to True Youth. Get it? True You, True Youth?
That's so good, Francis, May said, her body overtaken by a surge of feeling for him, some mix of empathy and pity and even admiration. I'll talk to you later. Developments like Francis's were happening with incredible frequency in those weeks. There was talk of the Circle, and Stenton in particular, taking over the running of San Vincenzo. It made sense, given most of the city's services were funded by and had been improved by the company. There was a rumor that Project 9 engineers had figured out a way to replace the random jumble of our nighttime dreaming with organized thinking and real-life problem-solving. Another Circle team was close to figuring out how to disassemble tornadoes as soon as they formed. And then there was everyone's favorite project, in the works for months now, the counting of the sands in the Sahara. Did the world need this? The utility of the project was not immediately clear, but the wise men had a sense of humor about it. Stenton, who had initiated the endeavor, called it a lark, something they were doing, first of all, to see if it could be done, though there seemed to be no doubt, given the easy algorithms involved, and only secondarily, for any scientific benefit. May understood it as most circlers did, as a show of strength, and as a demonstration that, with the will and ingenuity and economic wherewithal of the Circle, no earthly question would remain unanswered. And so, throughout the fall, with a bit of theatricality, they dragged out the process longer than necessary, for it only took them 3 weeks to count, they finally revealed the number of grains of sand in the Sahara, a number that was comically large and did not, immediately, mean much to anyone, beyond the acknowledgement that the Circle did what they said they would do. They got things done, and with spectacular speed and efficiency. The main development, and one that Bailey himself zinged about every few hours, was the rapid proliferation of other elected leaders in the U.S. and globally who had chosen to go clear. It was, to most minds, an inexorable progression. When Santos had first announced her new clarity, there was media coverage, but not the kind of explosion anyone at the Circle had hoped for. But then, as people logged on and began watching, and began realizing that she was deadly serious, that she was allowing viewers to see and hear precisely what went into her day, unfiltered and uncensored, the viewership grew exponentially. Santos posted her schedule each day, and by the second week, when she was meeting with a group of lobbyists wanting to drill in the Alaskan tundra, there were millions watching her. She was candid with these lobbyists, avoiding anything like preaching or pandering. She was so frank, asking the question she would have asked behind closed doors, that it made for riveting, even inspiring, viewing. By the third week, 21 other elected leaders in the U.S. had asked the Circle for their help in going clear. There was a mayor in Sarasota, a senator from Hawaii, and not surprisingly, both senators from California. The entire city council of San Jose, the city manager of Independence, Kansas, and each time one of them made the commitment, the wise men zinged about it, and there was a hastily arranged press conference showing the actual moment when their days went transparent. By the end of the first month, there were thousands of requests from all over the world. Stenton and Bailey were astounded, were flattered, were overwhelmed, they said, but were caught flat-footed. The Circle couldn't meet all the demand, but they endeavored to do so. Production on the cameras, which were as yet unavailable to consumers, went into overdrive. The manufacturing plant in China's Guangdong province added shifts and began construction on a second factory to quadruple their capacity. Every time a camera was installed and a new leader had gone transparent, there was another announcement from Stenton, another celebration, and the viewership grew. By the end of the fifth week, there were 16,188 elected officials from Lincoln to Lahore who had gone completely clear, and the waiting list was growing. The pressure on those who hadn't gone transparent went from polite to oppressive. The question from pundits and constituents was obvious and loud. If you aren't transparent, what are you hiding? Though some citizens and commentators objected on grounds of privacy, asserting that government at virtually every level had always needed to do some things in private for the sake of security and efficiency, the momentum crushed all such arguments, and the progression continued. If you weren't operating in the light of day, what were you doing in the shadows? And there was a wonderful thing that tended to happen. Something that felt like poetic justice. Every time someone started shouting about the supposed monopoly of the Circle, or the Circle's unfair monetization of the personal data of its users, or some other paranoid and demonstrably false claim, soon enough it was revealed that that person was a criminal or deviant of the highest order. One was connected to a terror network in Iran. One was a buyer of child porn. Every time, it seemed, they would end up on the news, footage of investigators leaving their homes with computers, on which any number of unspeakable searches had been executed, and where reams of illegal and inappropriate materials were stored. And it made sense. Who but a fringe character would try to impede the unimpeachable improvement of the world? Within weeks, the non-transparent office holders were treated like pariahs. The clear ones wouldn't meet with them if they wouldn't go on camera, and thus these leaders were left out. Their constituents wondered what they were hiding, and their electoral doom was all but assured. In any coming election cycle, few would dare to run without declaring their transparency, and it was assumed this would immediately and permanently improve the quality of candidates. There would never again be a politician without immediate and thorough accountability, because their words and actions would be known and recorded and beyond debate. There would be no more back rooms, no more murky deal-making. There would be only clarity, only light. It was inevitable that transparency would come to the Circle, too. As clarity among elected officials proliferated, there were rumblings inside and outside the Circle. What about the Circle itself? Yes, Bailey said, in public and to the Circlers, we should also be clear. We should also be open. And so started the Circle's own transparency plan, which began with the installation of 1,000 sea change cameras on campus. They were placed in common rooms, cafeterias, and outdoor spaces first. Then, as the wise men assessed any problems they might pose for the protection of intellectual property, they were placed in hallways, work areas, even laboratories. The saturation was not complete. There were still hundreds of more sensitive spaces without access, and the cameras were prohibited from bathrooms and other private rooms. But otherwise the campus, to the eyes of a billion-odd Circle users, was suddenly clear and open. And the Circle devotees, who already felt loyal to the company and enthralled by its mystique, now felt closer, felt part of an open and welcoming world. There were 8 sea change cameras in May's pod. And within hours of them going live, she and everyone else in the room were provided another screen on which they could see a grid of their own and lock into any view on campus. They could see if their favorite table at the glass eatery was available. They could see if the health club was jammed. They could see if the kickball game was a serious one or for duffers only. And May was surprised by how interesting Circle campus life was to outsiders. Within hours, she was hearing from friends from high school and college who had located her, who now could watch her work. Her middle school gym teacher, who had once thought May insufficiently serious about the president's physical fitness test, now seemed impressed. "Good to see you working so hard, May." A guy she dated briefly in college wrote, "Don't you ever leave that desk?" She began to think a bit harder about the clothes she wore to work. She thought more about where she scratched, when she blew her nose or how, but it was a good kind of thinking, a good kind of calibration. And knowing she was being watched, that the Circle was, overnight, the most watched workplace in the world, reminded her
more profoundly than ever, just how radically her life had changed in only a few months. She had been, 12 weeks ago, working at the public utility in her hometown, a town no one had heard of. Now, she was communicating with clients all over the planet, commanding 6 screens, training a new group of newbies, and altogether feeling more needed, more valued, and more intellectually stimulated than she ever thought possible. And, with the tools the Circle made available, May felt able to influence global events, to save lives even, halfway across the world. That very morning, a message from a college friend, Tanya Schwartz, came through, pleading for help with an initiative her brother was spearheading. There was a paramilitary group in Guatemala, some resurrection of the terrorizing forces of the 80s, and they had been attacking villages and taking women captive. One woman, Ana Maria Herrera, had escaped and told of ritual rapes, of teenage girls being made concubines, and the murders of those who would not cooperate. May's friend, Tanya, never an activist in school, said she had been compelled to action by these atrocities, and she was asking everyone she knew to join in an initiative called We Hear You, Ana Maria. Let's make sure she knows she has friends all over the world who will not accept this, Tanya's message said. May saw a picture of Ana Maria sitting in a white room on a folding chair, looking up, expressionless, an unnamed child in her lap. Next to her picture was a smile button that said, I hear you, Ana Maria, which, when clicked on, would add May's name to a list of those lending their support to Ana Maria. May clicked the button. Just as important, Tanya wrote, is that we send a message to the paramilitaries that we denounce their actions. Below the picture of Ana Maria was a blurry photo of a group of men in mismatched military garb walking through dense jungle. Next to the photo was a frown button that said, We denounce the Central Guatemalan Security Forces. May hesitated briefly, knowing the gravity of what she was about to do, to come out against these rapists and murderers. But she needed to make a stand. She pushed the button. An auto-response thanked her, noting that she was the 24,726th person to send a smile to Ana Maria and the 19,282nd to send a frown to the paramilitaries. Tanya noted that while the smiles were sent directly to Ana Maria's phone, Tanya's brother was still working on a way to get the frowns to the Central Guatemalan Security Forces. After Tanya's petition, May sat for a moment, feeling very alert, very aware of herself, knowing that not only had she possibly made a group of powerful enemies in Guatemala, but that untold thousands of sea change watchers were seeing her doing it. It gave her layers of self-awareness and a distinct sense of the power she could wield in her position. She decided to use the restroom, to throw some cold water on her face and use her legs a bit, and it was in the bathroom that her phone buzzed. The caller ID was blocked. Hello? It's me, Calden. Where have you been? It's complicated now, all the cameras. You're not a spy, are you? You know I'm not a spy. Annie thinks you are. I want to see you. I'm in the bathroom. I know. You know? Circle search, sea change. You're not hard to find. And where are you? I'm coming. Stay there. No, no. I need to see you. Stay there. No, I can see you later. There's a thing in the New Kingdom. Open mic folk night. A safe public place. No, no, I can't do that. You can't come here.